Okay, our speaker tonight is somebody who has redefined going to any lengths. And this is somebody who I'm very fond of in the rooms and does a lot of service work. And with that, I'll give you Debbie.
Hey everybody, I'm Debbie and I'm an alcoholic.
Hello.
I am been asked to do my story. I think I've done this is probably the fourth time I've done it here since I got sober. My very first time to do it, my sponsor at the time, she had asked me to tell my story, and I think I'd just gotten a year, and I said no. I said I'm not ready for that. That's too scary for me. And then her birthday rolled around, and I said, "What do you want me to get you for your AA birthday?" She said, "I want you to tell your story." So I couldn't refuse. So at that particular meeting, I believe I just got to sit up here at the desk and tell it. I don't think I had to stand at the podium. So that was my first experience with telling my story, and I don't mind saying I was extremely nervous. But since then, I've told it several other times and other clubhouses too. And it doesn't make me any less nervous, but nevertheless, here I am, and I have gone to great lengths to get here. Rachel and I prayed all the way here. I was like, "Oh my gosh, I don't know if we're gonna." When we were coming up the access road, when we crossed over Claremont, I said, "Wouldn't it be funny if we get stuck here?" But we had our walking clothes. We're gonna hike on in. I'll start off with my sobriety date, which is March 17th, 1997. So, good Lord willing, this coming St. Patrick's Day, I'll have 14 years. And I always like to tease that I came in here instead of getting that old green beer, because that's definitely what I used to do. And St. Patrick's Day was probably one of my favorite drinking holidays. But I was born in a little town in the heart of the Blue Ridge Mountains called Galax, Virginia. And I think that's one other reason I was able to get here tonight, because driving in the snow is what I got used to when I lived there. And I probably, you know, some of my earliest memories, I think I was an alcoholic before I ever took my first drink, because I was already sneaking around in line, because I remember my mom worked, so did my dad. They worked in, it's a textile factory kind of town, and my dad worked in a factory called Bluemont, where they knitted material and dyed it, and then they would cut it to go to cutting rooms to make whatever, uniforms or whatever. And then my mom worked at the Haynes Knitting Mill, and she made, I think she put the elastic around men's underwear on the sewing floor. And I hated for them to go to work. I can remember that. I hated that. And so she was always getting me babysitters, and I'd lie on them, so she'd have to fire them. Because in my mind, as a small child, I thought if I got the babysitter fired, then my mama wouldn't leave me to go to work. But she'd turn around and get another babysitter, or I'd end up going to my grandma's. So I already knew how to lie to get what I wanted at a very early age. And and I think living was pretty tough for them too, because I know they didn't make much money back then. I think Mama made, I don't know, 60 cents an hour or something like that, and Daddy too. And my mother's brother got a job at General Motors at the Doraville plant, and so we ended up moving to Duluth, Georgia in 64, and then we come on behind him in February of 1965, and we lived in Dad got us a trailer at Pleasant Hill Trailer Park, and that's on Pleasant Hill Road in Duluth. And right now that's where Gwinnett Place Mall is, but it was one of the largest trailer parks around. So that's where we started our life here in Georgia, was at Pleasant Hill Trailer Park. And I was five. I started school at Duluth Middle school. Well, it was I guess some elementary and middle school, and then they built B.B. Harris. So I went to elementary school at B.B. Harris. I went to Duluth Middle School, and I went on to Duluth High School and graduated from Duluth High School in 1978. And but during, I guess, my high school years, right, maybe I was in middle school, my very first drink was when I was 13. My parents didn't drink much, but they did entertain, so they always had a liquor cabinet. So Mama was a workaholic, and my dad worked nights at GM, and me and my sister and a few other kids around the neighborhood. Hey, David. got in my dad's liquor cabinet, and we just so they couldn't tell liquor was gone. You know, we'd pour a little bit of every bottle into a big old tumbler glass, and we all just passed it around. And I don't think I got drunk. I'm sure I got buzzed, and you know, but I can remember trying to, you know, act like I was more drunk than I was, and acting silly and stuff like that. And then I don't think I drank much more after that till I was in the 11th grade. And we had a good football team. We were we went to state. I don't know if y'all remember the Heisman Trophy winner George Rogers, but he played. He graduated a year before I did, and so he was on our football team. And we had a great year. Went to state. Went to Statesboro, but we lost big time. I was in the Flag Corps and in the marching band, and. So when we finished the game, one of the drill team girls knew a guy that, you know, was of age, and he went to the liquor store and got a pint of tequila and brought it to us. And me and she and I had, you know, like I said, I'd only drank that one other time when I was 13. By this time I was 15, 16. And we proceeded to drink that tequila straight. And I don't remember much after, you know, about half pint, because she and I shared it, and except for what everybody else told me happened, and because I blacked out that night. And our band director had room check at 11 or 12 or something like that, and my sister was trying to get me sobered up enough to where when she came in for room check, you know, I wouldn't get in trouble or get suspended from school. And so what she thought she should do was she put me in a bathtub and had I don't know how many people going to the ice machine and pouring ice on me. And I don't know how much I threw up. I don't remember anything except for they got me where I wasn't heaving and got me in bed and covered me up, so when she did room check, it looked like I was asleep. And but I remember that ride home, and I swore to God I'd never drink again. I was so sick, and I was really, you know, I was scared too, because I didn't know what I had done or what, you know, people were saying about me or what kind of rumors were going to go around school about me being drunk, you know. And but evidently, you know, everything stayed pretty quiet. I didn't get a lot of feedback on that, but I just knew that I was not going to drink again. And but it probably, I don't know, within a month I was drinking. We used to go, there was this little store called Mojo's. I don't know if y'all know that. Mojo's on Buford Highway in Whitey. I owned that store. And a guy I went to high school with, Eddie Oliver, he sold draft. You could buy, you get a gallon, like an old milk jug, and put it under a draft tap. And we'd go in and get us a gallon of draft. And then we'd go up to Lake Lanier, and all of us would party every weekend. And so that was kind of how I started my drinking career. We probably drank about every weekend, and you know, did that through high school. And then I graduated from high school, and I went to West Georgia College. And when I was at West Georgia College, I, for some reason, the guy who was making room assignments gave me a room in Tice Hall, which was an upperclassman dorm with 24-hour visitation. So I thought I had arrived. All I had to do was find an upperclassman to share my dorm room with, and then I could live at Tice Hall. So I did. One of my girlfriends went to West Georgia that was a year older than me, so we were able to get in there. And we had one of the RA's rooms, so it was like a little den. We had our own bathroom. All the other people had to share bathrooms with, it was adjacent bathrooms to the rooms and everything like that. So we had a nice little setup, and that was the party room. It was on the bottom floor, and people were in and out all the time. I can remember we kept a keg in the bathtub half the time. How I got through that first year of college without flunking out anything, I don't know, because I went to very few classes and just made it by the skin of my teeth. But that first year in college, I realized that I was not college material. That was just I just was not cut out for college. So I ended up just dropping out of college and getting a job. And still lots of drinking, lots of pot smoking too, but I really didn't do it, a whole lot of drugs, but mostly it was alcohol. And when I got a job on Spring Street in downtown Atlanta at a place called General Communications, and that was the very first beeper company and mobile cell phone company in Atlanta. And they didn't have the cell phones were installed in vehicles, so I got the job on the service side, where I would add beepers to people's accounts, and I would schedule installations for mobile telephones. And there was back then there was only UHF and VHF, and there was a 99 capacity for each of those, and VHF was the best. You got the best range on that. UHF wasn't as good, but if you worked around town, then you could use your cell phone and get good reception. But could you imagine, all the people who have cell phones now, back then there was only 99 capacity on each of those cell phone things. So we had a long waiting list, a very, very long waiting list for people, especially for VHS, and probably 2 years. And people paid real good to get put on the top of that waiting list, and I found that out pretty early on, too. And so I did a little bit of that, and zeroed out people's call counts because they would come in and give me concert tickets or stuff like that. And I was so stupid, I didn't realize I was stealing from that company. What was zeroing out somebody's cell phone account? What was just taking a little money off the top, just put somebody up to the top of the list and stuff like that? So to this day, I have been, they morphed on into, they're probably, I can't remember, AirTouch, and then they went into Verizon Wireless. So I've had an account with the Verizon Wireless for I don't know how many years now, probably about 20 years, and that's the way I kind of make an amends to all the money I took from them by skimming. And let's see, I had my first, I was there for about 3 years, and right up here at Northeast Plaza was a club called Packets, and it was a disco, and we practically lived at Packets, just every night, and there'd be lots of nights that, I'd get in just in time to take a shower and make it into work. But I went to work, I was the kind of alcoholic that would beat myself up and say, you get your ass up, you get into work, you did this to yourself. So I didn't lay out of work, and I was a pretty good employee. And but I just knew that something went right about the way I was living and the way I was carrying on, because there was a lot of I was pretty promiscuous and just love the one you're with. That's what it was back then, in the 70s and 80s. And so I decided I'd take my first geographical cure. I knew if I moved back up to Galax that there wasn't a whole lot to do up there in that little mountain town, and I'd probably straighten up. So I told my employer I was going to quit and move up to Galax. And I eventually got up there, and that's, I guess, where I, when I know now that everywhere you go, there you are, because it didn't take me long to find people just like me, and I was right back in the same kind of rut that I was in with, you know, drinking too much and feeling like crap. But I got a job in the bank there. It was called Bank of Carroll in Hillsville, Virginia. And I moved in with my dad's mom, and she got pretty tired of me coming in really late at night and stuff like that. So I ended up moving in with my cousin, and I met a bunch of people who liked to horseback ride. So we got into horseback riding, and I met my first husband, and we ended up getting married, and it was a very, very heavy drinking, volatile, violent, abusive marriage. And I moved up there in 82, and I married him in 83, and I had my first child in 1985, who is here tonight. And I don't know to this day, if I hadn't had a kid, if I might still be in that marriage, because she was the main thing that got me out of that just crazy fighting and yelling and screaming. I just didn't, you know, I had all that in me to fight like that and to act like that. And but I could not stand watching that my little girl, you know, witness, you know, what we were going through. And she wasn't but about a year and a half, almost 2 years old, when I finally left and left for good, because I left a lot of times. But we had horses, you know, when I was married to him, and we used to horseback ride every single weekend. Sometimes we'd take 20-mile rides, and he was a farrier, so we'd go to horse auctions, and we'd buy horses and break them, and then we'd turn around and sell them, and or we'd go all around the countryside and shoe horses, and I would kind of be his whatever you call it, scrub nurse. I'd hand him the tools while he was, you know, shoeing the horses, or I'd hold them on a twitch if they were mean horses, so he could get them shoed, not kill the both of us. And I learned a lot. I mean, I really did. I learned. We lived in an old farmhouse. It actually was in his family. His great grandparents had lived there. It was on 40 acres, and way down in a holler, and if the wind blew too hard, you could see the rugs flutter and the pictures, you know, move on the walls. And we pretty much lived hand to mouth too. And I'd been raised in a kind of a upper middle class home, you know, with good parents. And but it taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about the value of a dollar. It taught me about how to live on the land. It gave me a lot of street smarts, you know, the common sense kind of stuff. I guess horse sense, in a way. And but it's still all the fighting and stuff. I just could not put Rachel through that. So I ended up leaving and coming back to Atlanta, moving in with my mother, and she had her own company by then, and she started a company that kept hospitals from going under. They kept them with the JCAHO standards. She developed two software packages and had a huge reimbursement team that would go in and code for reimbursement with their hospital coders. If you get if you code an illness and it's not right, it'll get kicked back, and you only have 90 days to resubmit it to the insurance company, or you lose the money, and hospitals will go down if that happens. So she had a great company. I was really proud of my mom. She's a go-getter. And so I worked for her company, and I did all the books, and ended up rebounding. And as soon as I got divorced, I went to the courthouse to get my papers to divorce with my fiance. I was going to get my divorce and turn around and marry him on the very same day. And when I went in to get the divorce, the judge wouldn't grant the divorce because Rachel's daddy hadn't had his signature notarized, so that kind of messed up my little wedding plans there. So about a month later, we did get married, and I went from the frying pan to the fire. I didn't think I could get worse than Danny, and I turned around and married a man that was crazier than Danny ever thought about being, and meaner too. But he liked to drink, and he didn't give me a hard time. Danny used to give me a real hard time about my drinking and just browbeat me and everything, although he drank as much or more than I did. And I like to pick guys that would drink worse than me, so that way I didn't, I could be the victim and that sort of thing. But Tim didn't fuss at me about my drinking like Danny did, so he was a man for me. So we got married, and he had two kids, so I had two stepchildren and Rachel, and that was a very short-lived marriage because it was just as violent, probably more violent and more volatile than my marriage with 6-year marriage with Danny. And so it didn't take me long to get out of that one, and I kept on living with my mama and working with her company, and I was able to make enough of a salary to be approved for FHA, some kind of loan, some kind of government funded loan for her first time homeowners. So I ended up building a house out in Auburn, Georgia, and it was just me and Rachel, and we lived there a couple years, and I was still working for Mom's company. But see, the thing that about this kind of company was the turnaround on money was real slow, because she had hospitals all over the United States, and the turnaround on the money was real slow, and she had 65 employees, so she had to keep getting investors, and every time she'd get investors, it would kind of dilute the company a little bit more. So I ended up, because I was the owner or the boss's daughter, they were kind of just pushing me out, so I ended up quitting, and I started my own business. And it was very, very hard to make the mortgage trying to start your own business. And but meanwhile, I'm probably 3 years out of a marriage. I was, even with the drinking, even with the trying to have a social life, trying to be a mom, and trying to be a single parent and that sort of thing, I don't know how I did it. I don't know how I, juggled all those hats, but I ended up meeting the man I'm married to today. We've been together 17 years, 18 years, together 18 years. But I knew he didn't drink like I did. So I remember when we, right before we got married, I thought to myself, this man don't drink like you do, Debbie. You're going to have to really keep it together. And so that's when I started control drinking. That was the most miserable. It was about 5 years of control drinking. And I cannot even describe how hard that was, because every time I took a drink, I never knew where it was going to take me. And I could remember looking at myself in the mirror and saying, just drink one tonight, Debbie. Don't overdo it. So it took me to sneak drinking. He would get up. He's a morning person. He'd get up and he'd open all the blinds, and I'd get up and I'd get the kids out to school, and I'd get everybody out the door, and I'd shut all the blinds, and sometimes I'd drink about a six pack, and I remember trying to get a shower, try to sober up, get the kids from school, and then act like nothing, had gone on. Right before he got home from work, I'd open a bottle of wine and have a glass of wine, and I'd say, "Hey, honey, let me fix you a glass of wine." And probably, a glass of wine, a bottle of wine a night. And he'd go out of town sometimes, and we'd buy wine by the case, and I'd write down the name of the year of the wine and the name of the wine, and I'd put that case away and go back to the store and replace it all. So when he got back in town, he wouldn't know I'd drink all that wine. And never saw to the extent I needed to see that I was in trouble, that I was drinking, that I had I had a double life. I was trying to be one person to the outside world, and I was just in hell, you know, on the inside world, trying to juggle alcohol. And it didn't even dawn on me either that I could just not drink. You know, I was going to control it one way or the other. I always chased, you know, one of those first highs where I got that perfect, you know, it wasn't a blackout. It was just that perfect feeling, like, you know, I'm sure y'all know what I mean. I chased that for years and years and years. And so anyway, I ended up getting really drunk one night. We had a party, and the kids were there, and Rachel came in. And I was playing the piano, and I don't know how to play the piano. And she sat down beside of me and was talking to me. And I can remember not being able to get my words out. I mean, it was just horrible. And the next morning, she came up to me with tears in her eyes. She said, "Mama," she said, "last night, you were so drunk." She was only 11. "You were so drunk, I could not even understand what you were saying." She said, "It scared me so bad. Will you please not do that anymore?" And I said, "No, honey, I won't do it anymore." And probably a month later, I did it again. And I got the kids off to school, and I looked at myself in the mirror, and I was crying, and I said, "Please, God," I said, "am I an alcoholic? Are you, Debbie, are you an alcoholic?" And I was going to church real regular, too, at that time. I was trying to pull spirituality in my life. I was trying to be a good mom and be a good wife. And by this time, too, I also had a three-year-old son. And I grabbed a Unity flyer, because that's the church I was going to at the time, and I opened it up, and there it was a heading for a workshop they were going to have the following Sunday, and it said, "Do you drink and periodically find yourself drunk?" Now, that's the first thing I opened up when I opened up that flyer was that heading. After I was bawling that I, you know, "Are you an alcoholic?" And "Oh my gosh, this is the workshop for me. Thank you." And I told my husband, we were going to Florida, and I said, "Randy," I said, "we have got to get back home by 4 o'clock Sunday. So I want to leave Florida early." And I knew that I was going to go to that workshop and find out either they're going to teach me how to drink, they're going to give me that secret to how I could drink successfully, or I was going to find out I was an alcoholic. So that weekend, my husband and I went out, and his parents were keeping the kids, and I got so drunk. We were going to stay out anyway, so we went to our hotel room after we had drank, you know, we had dinner, and then we drank and listened to some music, and I mean, I don't know why, I guess maybe that was my last drink, and I got so drunk, blacked out, and I got up about 6 a.m. and went to the bathroom, and that bathroom was so horrible. Evidently, I had gotten so ill, you know, during the night, and didn't even remember it. I walked out of the bathroom and woke up my husband, and I said, "Did you get sick, honey?" And he said, "No." So that was, I had been that ill. It was mortifying. It was scary. It was like, oh my God, I cannot believe I did that to myself. And we got home. That was on a Friday night. I was sick Saturday, and we drove home Sunday. I went to that workshop, and he was actually an attorney from California who had written a book, and that's really what he was trying to do, was get people to buy his book. But he was a huge advocate for AA, and that's what got him help, and he talked about getting a sponsor and stuff like that. So I pretty much surrendered during that workshop to my most inner self that I was an alcoholic. So I called my, who was my first sponsor. We also sang in the choir together, and every time I'd go to a women's retreat, she would get up in front of all the women and just give a little bit of her story. So I knew who to call as soon as I got home. And so I called her. It was Jenny, Ginger K. I don't know if any of y'all know her, but she moved out to Texas. And I said, "Ginger," I said, "I'm an alcoholic, and I want to know if you'll sponsor me." And she said, "Sure, meet me at Nava tomorrow night at the 5:45. I said, meet you where? And so she told me how to get here, and she met me in there in the lobby. And that was March 17th, 1997. We came in here, and I sat down right about where Rachel is, and when they gave out the chips, I picked up a white chip, and that's been the only white chip I've ever had. And I have strayed very little from Nava since that day. This is my, I love this place. This is like not even 10 minutes from where I live, and I'm sure there's not a meeting I haven't hit in this clubhouse, but I got right into it. She told me, she said, Debbie, you're going to have to do 90 meetings in 90 days. She said, you're going to have to put AA before everything, and call me, and, you know, so we started working the steps, and I'm sure I did 90 and 90. I may have done more than 90 and 90, but I started coming to the 11 o'clock. So the very next day, on Tuesday, I came to the 11 o'clock, loved it. There's so much strong sobriety in the 11 o'clock meeting. And so I made it my home group, still my home group today. And I probably got, she wanted me to read, we went through the 12 and 12, and she wanted me to read the first step every day for 2 weeks. If I messed up, I had to start all over again. So, same thing with the second, same thing with the third, and then we got on to the fourth step. And when I got to the, when we did our first three steps, she started me on my fourth step. And I didn't have any problem with first step. I knew I was powerless over alcohol by that time, and I understood the unmanageability of trying to live life with alcohol, because although I didn't have no jail time, no DUIs, I had lots of wrecks, and I had a lot of wreckage of the past with, you know, ex-husbands and living just real insane life. I never have a problem with power greater than me. I didn't blame God for being an alcoholic. I didn't blame God for my, you know, for the things that happened in my life. But I did think that, you know, crap happens and life just happened. I didn't know that, you know, that I'm responsible. I'm responsible for the life I live. I was very, very lucky to have at Unity, Albert Wingate was the minister there, and he had 20-some years in AA. And when he would, you know, give his talks on Sundays, you could hear a lot of AA come in. And he was very open about being a recovering alcoholic, too. He had been an attorney out of Texas and very, very open about being an alcoholic. And I guess he was planting seeds even then. And so he said one Sunday I was hungover, and he said, look around you. He said, look around you in your life. Are you happy? Because you're responsible. And that was before I had come in, but that was, I think, one of the biggest seeds that was ever planted for me, that I had to take responsibility for my life. I had spent all this time being a victim of everything that happened to me up to that point, and I really reveled in being a victim. It was I like to tell my story, and I like for people to say, oh my God, I can't believe you lived through that, and people, you know, you had that done to you, and stuff like that, never knowing that that was my choice. Nobody made me go through those things or marry those people and live like I lived. And so anyway, came to believe a power greater than me wasn't a problem at all. I felt like I was at home when I got here, because it is so much like where I went to church. I mean, you are welcome to have your own higher power there. And the sanity bothered me a little bit, because I never considered myself, you know, having a mental illness. Or, and then when I heard that it was doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result, then I could wrap my brain around that, because I had certainly done that for years and years and years. And then making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, as I understood Him, no problem there. That third step prayer was, I got on my knees every morning for probably the first year and did the third step prayer. And I don't know what it was about that prayer. It just made me I just got this huge sense of relief because I did come in probably initially because I wanted to be a good example to my kids. By that time, like I said, I had Rachel was 11 and John was 3, and Rachel was starting, you know, on the verge of becoming a teenager. And how can I stand there and say, don't do as I do as I say do? You know, I used to hear that when I was a kid, and that never flew too well with me. If you could do it, I could do it too. And I wanted to be a good example to my kids. So when the third step prayer says, relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will and take away my difficulties, that victory over them will bear witness. That was the part that really brought me the comfort that, okay, victory over this stuff is going to bear witness, and I will help be a good example, a good mother, a good role model for my kids. And then the searching and fearless moral inventory, I was so ready to do my fourth step, but I couldn't put 2 weeks together reading the fourth step without missing once and having to start all over again. And this went on for like 3 or 4 months, and I finally went to Ginger and I said, look, Ginger, I said, I have read that fourth step way over, you know, the 14 times you'd have to do it every night to get in the 2 weeks straight. I said, I keep messing up, but I have read it, you know, probably for 3 months now. I'm ready to do my fourth step. I want to do it. And she said, no, ma'am. I said, well, look, I'm going to have to find another sponsor then. I said, I want to get this over with. She said, well, let me talk to my sponsor, and I'll get back with you. She said, don't get a new sponsor yet. And so she ended up calling me back, and she said, I talked to my sponsor, and she pretty much said, get the donkey out of the ditch, and me being the donkey, and let me do my fourth step. And, you know, the thing about my fourth step, like I said before, there wasn't a whole lot I hadn't shared with people. I mean, I didn't have a lot of secrets, because you can't have secrets when you're a victim. You have to tell people your story so you can have the victim role. The biggest psychic change for me when I did my fourth step was the responsibility in my part with that, with taking that step, when I did my fifth step. And, you know, the sense of ease and comfort that came with, you know, talking to another person and hearing them say, been there, done that too, that always meant a lot to me. I've told this story before when I've shared in meetings. When I was 8 years old, I had this phobia. You know, I'd hear about somebody dying or somebody getting cancer or something, and I would be scared to death. I mean, crying and, like, you know, just thinking I had that, and I realized what mortality was at age 8. And somebody would say, oh, that's silly, you know, don't do that, you don't need to, you know, go there with that. And it didn't give me any kind of comfort. But if somebody said, I've done that too. I had somebody say to me, yeah, that happened to me, and I thought I had the same thing. And I went, you did? And at once I was eased of being afraid I was going to die from whatever, you know, disease I thought I had at that time. And that's what this program does. You know, when you have somebody sit across from you and say, yep, been there, done that, felt the same way. That I think that's probably the crux of this program, what makes it work, that we can share with one another and know where we are with each other. Entirely ready to have God remove all my defects of character. Well, you know, that's even at 13 plus years, those defects of character still rear their ugly heads, but I can tell you they're not as profound, and I have learned to use restraint of pen and tongue. I have learned to place principles before personalities. I have learned that being right is not as good as being happy, and that I can give somebody the benefit of the doubt that they may be right. I can even honor somebody else's perception, that we have different perceptions, which I could not do before then. I had to be right, and I would fight you to be right, and even if it was fist fighting. And I ceased fighting. Same with the shortcomings. I mean, I think they go hand in hand. When I did my amends list, the biggest people on my amends list were my immediate family and my mom and Rachel, because Rachel lived with me. She saw the most of my drinking, and so we would go. She'd say, "Mama, you need to come with me." And she had this little playhouse in the backyard, and she'd take me out. "Come on, Mama, we need to go out to the playhouse." And I thought, "Oh, shit, I know what." You know, so she would rake me over the coals in on her turf in her playhouse. And I'd listen to her, and we'd go for walks. And Rachel had a lot to process. You know, she had a lot of stuff she needed to tell me about and needed to ask me about, needed to let me know she it hurt her and I was wrong and that sort of thing. And I'll never forget one time we were walking and she said, and she started in, and I said, "Rachel," I said, "listen," I said, "we've been over this a few times, and this is the last time I want you to do this. I want you to go ahead and say what you need to say to me, because I can pretty much tell you what it's going to be already." I said, "But this is the last time. I want you to get past this." And she later on thanked me. She said, "Mama, I'm so glad you thanked me from doing that." I think she thought it was her job to just keep, you know, raking me over the coals for the, you know, my wreckage. And that way she could move on. And, you know, we've done a lot of work together in recovery, and I think it's been good for both of us. And I know it's been good for our relationship. She is definitely one of my best friends. I made my amends to everybody I knew to make my amends to, and I did talk to my sponsor before I made them, and you know, talked about how we'd let that happen. And like I already mentioned, the Verizon Wireless, I still have service with them, and will from here on out, because that's the way, like I said, I make that amends. And then things have cropped up over the years. You know, I'll be just tootling along, and I'll go, "Oh, I bet I need to talk to somebody about that one." And I had one in my crawl. It was a girl that I went to high school with. And I felt like I owed her an amends, and I knew I was going to see her at one of my class reunions. So we were in the in line. It was a buffet, and so I decided to make my amends to her in the buffet line. She had no idea what the hell I was talking about. And all those years, it had bothered me, you know, about how our friendship ended and stuff. And she just had no idea what I was talking about. So that goes to show, sometimes you got stuff that bothers you, and it ain't bothering anybody else. They don't think about it. So that's when I think I learned not to take myself and some of my stuff so seriously. Continue to take personal inventory. These are all action steps, and I do the best I can to kind of at night look at my day, and really more than not is pat myself on the back when I've done good stuff, because I always am the first to beat myself up over stuff. I mean, I think that was part of one of my biggest isms with alcoholism, was me being my own worst enemy and beating myself up and having such a low self-esteem and not being good enough. And so, you know, I like to look at my day when I take my inventory, and certainly fix things promptly if I feel like I owe an apology to somebody. Talk to a sponsor. I've talked to my sponsor about some things that bother me, and she said, "In my opinion, Debbie, you do not owe an apology." So, you know, so sometimes I don't have to go there, but I'm sure glad I have a sponsor to talk to help me figure those kinds of things out. And not that if I disagreed with her, I wouldn't go ahead and do it too, you know, because I do have a brain, and I can clean up things if I think I need to, whether she thinks so or not. And the prayer meditation part has been such a huge. I was trying to do prayer meditation hungover. I mean, I started that part of my life before I ever even came into AA. So it has gotten, you know, even stronger since I've been in AA. And I usually, get up in the morning, get my coffee, and I go to my my prayer chair is what I call it. It's in my living room, and I pull out my readings, and I try to take time every day, and I bring my family into it too. I mean, a lot of mornings before they go to school, they'll come in and listen to the readings, and that way they start up their day out right. And when I first came into AA, I got real diligent about getting a walk every morning and then doing my prayer meditation and changing. You hear so many people say so many things in the rooms. I couldn't think my way into right action. I had to act my way into right thinking, and you know, and I don't try to argue what came first, the hen or the egg. But for me, I know I changed my thinking. I stayed real conscious of what thoughts ran through my mind, and I had no idea how crazy my thinking was. I never was conscious about what was running around in my head and how negative some of the stuff that was running around in my head was. So when I became conscious of my thinking, I would say cancel. If I caught myself saying something negative or saying something ugly, I would say cancel, and I would make myself say something positive. It was exhausting. It was every waking moment when I first came into this program that I was changing around the way I was thinking. So that helped me into right action. So that's my story, and I still have to do that, but it's not as exhausting. I can put some waking time together in a day's time and actually have nice, good, positive thoughts about people and about myself and about what's going on that day and what my day will hold. And so, and I know that's just because of this program and being diligent about staying aware of what runs around in my head. And it's very entertaining too. I mean, I have some thoughts that I just have to thank myself for sharing, because it's really crazy thoughts. But that's one of the things too that I've learned in here, that I don't have to take myself so seriously. Life is meant to have fun, and I'm human, and I'm going to have nutty thoughts and nutty scenarios running around in there, but I don't have to act out on them. And I used to have to act out on them. The 12th step was the spiritual awakening. I believe they say it happens during the 5th step, but I think there's a spiritual awakening after every one of the steps in some way. And when you get to the 12th step and you are asked to tell your story, or someone comes up and asks you to sponsor them. I've been sponsoring women probably since I was in my second year of recovery. And I have 9 sponsees, and every one of them has multiple years now. My oldest sponsee has 7 years in the program. My youngest one has 3. And I talk to these women mostly on a weekly basis, some every single day. And I don't think I would have ever met them had I not walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're such a vital part of my recovery and such a joy to watch how their lives have changed. I mean, it is just... And that's another part of the 3rd step is that part where we bear witness, And I love these women. I just love them. And I think they feel the same way. Anyway, my life today is pretty darn good. I have a very loving family. I have 3 children now. I had my 3rd child was I was a little over a year sober when I got pregnant, and when I first found out I was pregnant, it was a surprise, and I was a little mad. I have to say I was a little mad, because I don't like being pregnant. I like them a lot better out than in. And I cannot tell you what my life would be without that child. And she's 12 now. And she's a light, isn't she, right? And I don't know what I'd do without her. But so I have three kids, a loving husband. I have my own business now. It was 7 years old in August. You know, we've been in the same house for 18 plus years. I'm so glad we're so close here to Napa. I've had opportunities to chair the Friday meeting. I got a new sponsor probably 3 years sober, and her name was Beverly. She used to sit right there on the wall, and I got to watch her go through her transition. And I got to be with her all through that. I've watched so many people in this program come in, known them for years, get sick, die sober, walk through their illness sober, walk in these rooms and bear witness. I have when Beverly died, I got another sponsor, and she's still my sponsor to this day, and she's actually the secretary of this clubhouse. I was asked to serve on the board. I got to serve on the board. I finished somebody's term, and then I served a three-year term. And I've served on PTAs. I've served on church boards, and I will tell you right here and right now, the most spiritual board I've ever, ever served with was the SNABA board. I mean, it wasn't that we all got along and things didn't get rough in that room in there sometimes, but we would stop and we would pray and we would place principles before personalities, and we would get the job done. And and I know that's why this clubhouse is still sitting here today. It's because a bunch of drunks got together with a common purpose and a common conscience to hold these doors open for people who were suffering to get sober. So anyway, that's my story, and I'm so glad I got to get out here tonight, y'all. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much, Debbie. That was really great. And I'm sure that if the weather cooperated, this would have been a packed house, because you're so loved here in these walls, in this room. A separate tradition, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, donation support for the group at AA at Zone. And can I get a volunteer to give out the chips? Thad, will you give out the chips?
I'm Danny. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Danny.
Like every other meeting, we have a chip system. If you're just coming in and you want to find a way of life, we offer you a white chip. Anybody want to pick up a white chip? If you've been here 30 days, we offer you a silver chip. 30 days. 90 days, we offer you a red chip. 90 days. 6 months, we offer you a yellow chip, sunshine. And 9 months, we offer you a green chip. Anybody got 9 months? And any sneakers for you?
Oh, all right. All right.
Tim, we're down college.
Yeah.
8 years.
And,
just a wonderful night for me. Couldn't be better. And Tim asked me a couple of months ago, he always knows. And you know, this may not make sense to anybody else. You hear people tell their story, and you hear them share their story. Hearing your story tonight. Thanks so much.
Give yourself a hand for chips.
Any AA related announcements? Okay. If you would like to become a member of this group, see one of the members who are raising their hands right now. I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. For those who will, we have a nice way of closing.
We're a good crowd tonight.
All right, close to the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Keep him in the back, it works, keep him working.
Congratulations, Sam.
You have it all right.
Yes, I have. And I see you. It's been a long time.
I know. Y'all feel so lucky. You got that guy, David, come over and got me. I was about to go crazy. A couple of days.
That's enough.
Yeah, he got four-wheel drive first for a week. We tried first car.
Yeah, Phil picked me up. Then we went and I go to his house. And then we picked him up.
I couldn't make it. I was full of big talk, so I was full of big talk.
I got out earlier today and...